Hey guys, and welcome to another episode of Ireland Crimes and Mysteries. I want to thank you for joining me today, and if you're a returning listener, I want to say a big thank you for your continued support. If this is your first time listening to my podcast, welcome. It's great to have you on board. So without further ado, let's get started on today's story. Today I want to tell you about a case that chilled not just a small Northern Ireland village, but an entire country. Now, most murders, grim as they are, tend to follow a pattern. They're usually committed by someone the victim knew. The evidence piles up quickly, and in most cases, the Gardaí, or the police in this case, are able to make the arrest within days. But every so often, a killing happens that leaves everyone, including seasoned investigators, completely baffled. No motive, no suspect, and no sense. This story is one of those. Let me take you back to 1952, to a place called White Abbey, just about 8 miles outside of Belfast. Back then, it was the kind of village where everyone knew everybody else's name, quiet and rural. The sort of place where the biggest event might have been a church bake sale. People didn't lock their doors, kids played in the street, and nothing truly awful ever seemed to happen there. That's where the Kern family lived. Judge Lance Kern, his wife and their 3 children, Desmond, Michael and Patricia. They all lived in a grand old house called the Glen. It sat on a spacious tree-lined grounds with a long driveway and a family dog. Everything you'd picture in a judge's country estate. Now, to understand the story of Patricia Kern and how her life came to such a violent and mysterious end, we first need to understand the world she came from. The Kerns weren't just any family. They were part of Northern Ireland's elite, living in a sprawling country estate called the Glen, just outside the village of White Abbey. The Kern family name carried weight in law, in politics, and in society. At the head of that family was Sir Lancelot Kern, a stern, imposing figure. Lance Kern was a barrister, a judge, and a former Unionist Member of Parliament. In the 1940s, he served as Attorney General for Northern Ireland and later became a High Court judge. He was the kind of man who believed in discipline, structure, and reputation. To those outside the family, he was respected, even feared. Inside the family, he was distant, formal, the embodiment of control. His wife, Lady Doris Kern, was a more complicated figure. She came from a troubled background. Her father had been the medical superintendent at Broadmoor, the infamous high-security psychiatric hospital in England. Doris was raised within those institutional walls. Some who knew her in life described her as eccentric. Others went further, suggesting she struggled with mental illness. After Patricia's murder, Doris was institutionalised, and rumours swirled for decades about what she may or may not have known. The Kerns, as I said, had 3 children. Desmond was the eldest. He would later become a Catholic priest and serve in South Africa. A surprising turn for a son of a Protestant judge. And one that some believe was shaped by the trauma of what happened in 1952. Then there was Michael, the middle child. White, steady, less often spoken about in the papers. And finally, there was Patricia. Patricia was the light in that cold, controlled household. 19 years of age, studying arts at Queen's University in Belfast, fiercely intelligent, charming, independent. She wasn't the kind of girl to sit around and be an ornament, basically. Not in a household filled with men of authority and of expectation. She challenged ideas. She taught for herself. That summer, she'd even taken a job as a lorry driver. Not something you'd expect from a judge's daughter back in the 1950s, I can assure you. But Patricia was different. She had dreams, she had personality, she had a sense of humour. She was warm, she was curious, and she was spirited. And in November 1952, she vanished, only to be found dead on the grounds of her own family's estate, stabbed 37 times. What followed was a case that shook the nation, not just because of the brutality of the murder, but because of who the Kearns were, because of the power they held, and because the deeper you looked into that family, the more uneasy it all became. Now, Patricia Kearn was born in 1933, as I said, making her 19 years of age at the time of her murder. She was an art student at Queen's University in Belfast in 1952, and as I said, she was described as very spirited and very independent. She was known for her intelligence and her determination. I mean, taking a job as a lorry driver in her position in society at the time was amazing, really. It showed her willingness to defy societal expectations. Now, Patricia's interests extended beyond academics. She was involved in various social activities and had a circle of friends who admired her vivacious personality. Her life, though tragically cut short, was marked by a blend of traditional upbringing and a progressive outlook, making her a fascinating figure in her own right. Now, she was close with her family, especially her brothers. But on the afternoon of November the 12th, 1952, she'd concluded her lectures for the day and she met with a friend called John Steele. They shared a cup of tea and engaged in conversation before Patricia departed to catch her usual bus back to White Abbey. She boarded the 5:20 p.m. bus and disembarked near the gates of her family home. This was the last confirmed sighting of Patricia alive. 11-year-old George Chambers, who was a local paperboy in White Abbey, had seen Patricia walking through the gates of her family estate shortly after she returned home from university at around 5:20 p.m. A few minutes later, George made his way up the driveway to deliver the evening newspaper. But as he approached the house, he heard a loud, sharp noise that really startled him. It was something really unusual and it was frightening enough that he turned and he basically ran back down the drive. His brief encounter would become a crucial part of the timeline, as he was technically the last known person to see Patricia alive and the only individual to report hearing anything suspicious during that critical window. Patricia was uncomfortable walking alone in the dark up that driveway, especially in winter. Typically, she'd ring from the gate and someone would come to walk her in. That evening, her brother Michael was home, but surprisingly, she neither rang the bell nor asked for help. Later, Mrs. Kearn, her mother, arrived home by taxi after an outing. She noticed Patricia hadn't returned, but the family wasn't immediately alarmed. They assumed she'd simply been delayed and would phone once she reached the village. Her father then returned home at around 6:45, and he, noticing Patricia's absence, began to worry. Patricia was never one to stay out late without calling. Something they felt was very wrong at this stage. The two Kearn brothers grabbed torches and began searching the grounds. By 2 a.m, friends and neighbours had joined the hunt. And just after 6 a.m, her brother Desmond found her, hidden in a patch of thick shrubbery just off the drive. Some reports claimed Patricia's body was found as early as 9:30 p.m, while the official discovery time recorded by police is that 6 a.m. in the morning time. That gap, and the uncertainty around it, is one of the many things that's kept suspicion alive in this case for over 70 years. Now, what Desmond Kearn found was devastating. After hours of searching through the dark grounds of Glen House, Desmond made that sickening discovery. She was lying in a load of rhododendrons near the driveway, and she was still wearing her university clothes and her little hat lay nearby. But the scene was horrific. Patricia's body was soaked in blood. As I said, she'd been stabbed 37 times. Some of the wounds were inflicted while she was still on her feet, as though she had tried to fight off her attacker. Others came after she'd fallen. Many of the injuries were concentrated on her chest, her shoulders and her upper back areas. It was clear this hadn't been a quick or calculated killing. It was a frenzied, violent attack. The kind driven by rage, really. Now, the murder weapon itself was never recovered, but the pathologist later said it was likely a slim, sharp object, possibly a penknife or small blade. Whatever it was, it had been used with terrifying force and speed. There was no evidence of any sexual assault and nothing had been stolen from Patricia, so it wasn't a robbery. And if it wasn't sexual violence, then what was the motive? Even more unsettling was the position of Patricia's body. Her remains had been moved. They'd been dragged roughly about 40 feet off the main path and left in a spot where the undergrowth was thick enough to conceal her from casual view. It suggested whoever had done this didn't want her discovered right away, but also hadn't taken the time to truly hide the evidence. Her glove was later found on the driveway. So was her handbag, but nothing, as I said, was missing. These items helped establish a timeline, indicating she had in fact made it through the gates and part of the way up the drive before she was attacked. Now here's where things get a bit murky. Some reports, including early media accounts, claimed Desmond, as I said, had found the body at 9:30 p.m. on the night of the 12th. But as I said, the police reports and later court testimony placed the discovery at around 6 a.m. the following morning. It's unclear why there is such a big discrepancy. Some believe the family may have found her earlier and delayed contacting authorities. Whether that was to protect someone, preserve their reputation, or simply due to shock, we don't know. But what's certain is, when police finally arrived at the scene, it had already been disturbed. The Curran family did, however, admit to moving Patricia's body, allegedly thinking she might be still alive. In fact, Sir Lancelot, Desmond and the family solicitor didn't just move her. They physically placed her in a car and drove her to a local doctor. And the doctor confirmed she was dead. After that, they brought the body back. It was placed possibly in an attempt to recreate the scene. Who knows? It's all very murky, as I said. But in doing so, any hope of preserving a clean crime scene was completely lost. Blood evidence, the body's position, possible drag marks, all of it was compromised. From the outset, investigators were working with a contaminated crime scene, predicting timelines and a powerful family at the centre of this storm. And all of that began with one terrible moment, a brother's discovery of the body of his sister brutally murdered, just yards, you could say, from her front door. The pathologist later confirmed that she died in or around 5:45 p.m. Something that's rarely talked about in all the reporting is Patricia Curran's funeral. And honestly, there's not much to go on. There's very little on the public record about it. Which I suppose is a bit telling in itself. No newspaper, photographs, no public statements, just silence on the matter. It's believed that Patricia was laid to rest privately somewhere in or around Belfast, likely in a Church of Ireland cemetery. As I said, the Currans were a prominent Protestant family, and it's thought they kept the service small, immediate family only, no press, no attention. Her death was, of course, acknowledged in the newspapers of the time, but the family avoided media coverage surrounding the burial. After Patricia's body was found, the investigation began immediately, but not without complications. The Royal Ulster Constabulary, the RUC, launched a full-scale inquiry led by Inspector Sir Richard Pym, a respected officer known for his experience in high-profile cases. The scene was Glen House, the Curran family estate in White Abbey, large, secluded, surrounded by trees and long gravel driveways. You can picture it in your head. There were other details too, one that didn't make headlines but quietly unsettled the people working the case. For one, the Curran family solicitor wasn't just present, as I said, after the body was found. He'd helped move it to the doctors and then back again. And when police finally saw the scene, they noted something strange. Patricia's books, her handbag and her beret were stacked neatly a few yards from her body, completely dry, even though it had been raining. Stranger still, there was very little blood at the location where her body was found, despite the fact she had been stabbed 37 times. That raised the question, was she killed somewhere else? Maybe even inside the house. That theory gained traction after it emerged that Judge Kern had refused police permission to search the house for over a week and instructed his family not to speak to investigators. And just days later, Patricia's bedroom was redecorated. All of it was legal, none of it was illegal, but it gave the growing sense that something wasn't right. From the beginning, as I said, the case was compromised. When police arrived on the scene early on the morning of the 13th of November 1952, Patricia's body had already been moved. The family later admitted this to investigators, explaining that they had believed she might still be alive when discovered. It was chaotic and emotional, and Desmond, her brother, had been the one to find her lying, as we said, in the undergrowth. But whatever the intention, that decision had serious consequences. The crime scene had been disturbed, the body repositioned, and any potential forensic evidence, blood splatter, footprints, drag marks, had all been disrupted. In modern investigations, this would be considered a critical procedural failure. Back then, it was noted, but not seriously challenged. Investigators did manage to recover some items. Patricia's gloves, as I said, and her beret and her handbag were found on the driveway. Her handbag was intact with nothing missing. That ruled out robbery. There was no signs of sexual assault either. And oddly, despite the frenzied, brutal nature of the stabbing, no one had heard her scream, except for the paper boy who heard that noise in around the time. But other than that, there was no eyewitnesses to the actual attack itself. But one local woman, a Mrs. Hetty Little, came forward with a potentially important observation. She said at around 6:30 p.m. on the evening of the murder, she saw a man leaving the glen. She described him as pale and nervous, wearing a long coat. She said he walked quickly, made brief eye contact with her but didn't speak. Then he vanished into the evening. Desperate for leads, police began reenacting Patricia's final movements, tracing her bus journey, her walk from the gate, trying to pin down the exact time and place of the attack. Investigators considered multiple possibilities. Was she attacked outside the gate and dragged in? Did someone lie in wait along the drive? Was it a stranger, maybe a motorist who had stopped and followed her? At the time, there had been reports of curb crawlers in the area, men loitering near bus stops or slowly circling in cars, often harassing young women. Police explored this angle and canvassed known offenders, but it led nowhere. By the time Christmas of 1952 rolled around, the Royal Ulster Constabulary had hit a wall. The Kern case, which had gripped the country, a young woman from a prominent family stabbed to death on her own driveway. And yet 6 weeks on, the RUC had made no arrests, they had no suspect, and very little in the way of solid leads. The pressure was on the investigation team and on Inspector Sir Richard Pym in particular. I mean, the pressure must have been immense. In an effort to prompt a breakthrough, police offered a £1,000 reward for information, which was a substantial sum of money at the time. But even that yielded nothing. With public pressure mounting and media speculation running wild, investigators began revisiting early interviews. That's when they turned their attention back to someone they had spoken to briefly at the start, a 21-year-old Scottish airman named Ian Hay Gordon, stationed at RAF Edenmore as part of his national service. At first glance, Gordon had seemed an unlikely suspect. He had no known history of violence, he didn't own a car, he wasn't from the area. But what raised eyebrows was that he had visited the Kern home once before, several weeks prior to the murder. It was a small detail at first. He had been introduced to Patricia's brother Desmond through mutual involvement in a church youth group. Desmond had even invited Gordon to dinner at Glen House. It was a polite societal connection. On paper, it was nothing more than that. But to police, That link made him stand out. The logic was simple. If Patricia was killed by someone she knew, and if the killer had walked with her up along the driveway without raising suspicion, then perhaps she hadn't been surprised at all. Perhaps she had seen her killer before. So detectives brought Gordon back in for more detailed questioning. They asked him to clarify his movements on the night of the murder, Wednesday the 12th of November. Gordon told him the same story he had told him at the very beginning. He'd left the camp that afternoon to post some letters in White Abbey, then returned to Eden Moor. He said he had a cup of tea, did some reading, and later went to the canteen. That was around 7:30 p.m. for another cup of tea. His story didn't change, at least not initially. But as investigators began checking his alibi, the cracks started to show. The key issue was the timeline. Patricia had been killed at around 5:45, according to the pathologist's estimate. That meant the critical window, the time during which someone could have attacked her, was between 5:15 and 6 p.m. So where was Gordon during that time? One of his colleagues, Corporal Connor, contradicted Gordon's account. He told police that he hadn't seen Gordon between 5 and 6:30 p.m. And more than that, Connor alleged that Gordon had asked him to lie and say they had taken tea together that evening. That statement shifted the tone of the investigation dramatically. Now, what once seemed like a polite young airman with nothing to hide began to look like a man trying to build a false alibi. That didn't prove he was guilty, of course. But from the RUC's perspective, it cast serious doubt on his credibility. And in a case with no clear suspect, no weapon, no forensic evidence, behaviour really became the evidence. Further interviews revealed small, subtle inconsistencies. Gordon was vague about the exact time he left the camp and posted the letters. Some said they saw him at the canteen later that evening around 7 or 7:30 p.m., which aligned with his story. But no one could vouch for his whereabouts between 5 and 6:30, the key time frame. This gap became the focus of police attention. The fact that Gordon had visited the Kearns once and now appeared to be covering up part of his timeline made him more than just suspicious. And his behaviour didn't help. He was reportedly nervous during questioning. At one point, he asked investigators whether Patricia had kept a diary and if he'd ever been mentioned in it. He also asked Desmond Kearns similar questions, which raised eyebrows further. On the 23rd of December, Desmond, Patricia's brother, had received a call from Ian. He sounded nervous, distressed even. They arranged to meet that evening at Valdor Cafe in Belfast. They spoke for nearly 3 hours. Desmond was so unsettled by the conversation that he went home and he wrote everything down. Ian had been grilled by the police and seemed terrified that somehow he was being dragged into the case. He asked Desmond what he had told investigators and admitted that he too had shared things about Desmond, even things he didn't want to tell. Then came a strange question. Gordon asked if Patricia had ever said anything about him. Did she keep a diary? He even wondered if she'd ever gone wandering into Belfast's rougher neighbourhoods out of curiosity, he said. Desmond said no. Then Gordon offered a theory. Maybe Patricia had been killed because she found out something about someone. That line stuck with Desmond, enough so that a few days later he passed the information on to the police. Why would he be worried about what had been written in Patricia's diary unless there was something he didn't want coming to light? The RUC continued to press him, pulling apart his account and probing the gap in his timeline. They examined his clothes, no traces of blood. They checked his movements after the estimated time of death, all of it vague, but none of it placing him with Patricia. The police had no physical evidence on him, no murder weapon, no eyewitness linking Gordon to the scene. But what they did have now was a suspect who lied about his alibi, who had a prior connection to the victim, was asking strange questions, and who seemed increasingly uncomfortable under pressure. And that, in the eyes of the RUC, was enough to keep digging. As the weeks dragged on with no rest, fear was spreading through White Abbey like wildfire. People began to look sideways at their neighbours. Rumours took root, then multiplied. In a tight-knit conservative village, anyone who didn't quite belong or who behaved oddly was suddenly a suspect. Strangers were eyed with suspicion. Local servicemen were quietly whispered about. And even an eccentric elderly man, known for walking around with hay in his hair, wasn't spared. In an effort to inject momentum into the stalled investigation, the RUC brought in Scotland Yard. Detectives John Capstick and Dennis Hawkins were flown in. Capstick, in particular, had a reputation for solving some of the UK's toughest murder cases. His arrival gave people hope. But after weeks of work, even he had nothing concrete to show. The Kern family quietly left Glen House. It had become a crime scene, a source of constant attention, and a house full of bad memories now. Police set up a temporary headquarters in the local girls' school. The atmosphere in White Abbey turned cold. Parents warned their daughters not to walk alone. Nobody lingered outside after dark. And still, the central question hung in the air. Who would have wanted Patricia Kern dead? And why? By January 1953, Ian Hay Gordon had returned to Belfast after spending the holidays in Scotland. Upon his arrival, the RUC resumed their interest in him. He was brought in for questioning multiple times. Then on January the 15th, something unexpected happened. Gordon confessed to the murder of Patricia Kern. He claimed it wasn't premeditated. According to his statement, he said it wasn't a willful murder, saying he went to the Glen that evening and encountered Patricia. They spoke and he asked to kiss her. She initially resisted, but eventually gave in. As the kiss progressed, he said he couldn't stop. When she protested, calling him a beast and trying to push him away, he snapped. He stated that he stabbed her, possibly with a service knife from his uniform, and then, in a dazed state, fled into the woods and discarded the weapon into the sea. The police finally had a confession. However, inconsistencies remained. There was no physical evidence linking Gordon to the crime. His clothing was clean, and the only blood found on his trousers could have come from an old cut. Despite his detailed statement, none of the timeline could be independently verified. No one had seen him with Patricia that night. Now, that lady, Mrs. Hetty Little, who said she saw the man leaving the driveway, did identify Gordon in a lineup as the man she had seen. But she had already seen a photo of him in the newspaper by this point, and that cast doubt on the reliability of her identification. By early March 1953, the trial of Ian Hay Gordon for the murder of Patricia Kern began at Belfast Crown Court. The public interest was enormous. This wasn't just any murder. It was the violent death of the daughter of a sitting High Court judge in one of the most exclusive addresses in Northern Ireland. Crowds gathered outside the court daily, queuing for hours in the cold just to get a glimpse of the proceedings. Inside the courtroom, the atmosphere was electric and deeply polarised. The prosecution painted Gordon as a troubled and sexually repressed young man, tormented by desire and rejection. They relied heavily on the confession he had made in January, in which he described going to the Glen House, seeing Patricia and asking for a kiss. According to that statement, as we said, she initially resisted but eventually gave in. And when she pulled away and called him a beast, he snapped. He described stabbing her repeatedly with what he believed may have been a service-issued knife, then running away in a fog of panic and tossing the weapon into the sea. The Crown insisted this confession was genuine, a detailed, voluntary admission by a man who knew he was guilty. But the defence, led by the flamboyant and theatrical barrister Bertie MacVeagh, told a very different story. They argued that Gordon hadn't fully understood what he was saying or even doing when he confessed. They said he was mentally unwell, suffering from hypoglycemia, a condition related to dangerously low blood sugars, and possibly schizophrenia and a history of blackouts. The defence further noted that Gordon had suffered a fractured skull the previous year, though the precise circumstances of the injury have never been publicly clarified. It was strongly implied that the head injury trauma may have contributed to his alleged disconnection with reality. Gordon, they argued, was not a criminal. He was a deeply isolated, socially awkward young man with poor emotional development and a history of psychiatric issues. A loner, intelligent, but fragile. Medical evidence became the battleground of the trial. Psychiatrists were called on both sides. The defence's experts said Gordon was vulnerable to psychological collapse and that the intense, prolonged police interrogations may have broken him down to the point where he confessed to something he didn't even do. They testified that his behaviour, medical background and personality profile made him an unreliable narrator of events. The prosecution's medical witnesses disagreed. They said Gordon may have had personal difficulties, but he was not legally insane. They contended that he had the capacity to understand right from wrong and knew exactly what he was doing. Then came the issue of physical evidence, or lack of it. No murder weapon had ever been recovered. Gordon's clothes were examined and no trace of Patricia's blood was found on them. The only spot of blood discovered on his trousers, police admitted, may have come from a small, unrelated cut. Furthermore, no witnesses had seen him with Patricia on the night she died. His supposed route to the Kern house that night could not be independently verified. And despite his confession claiming that he had discarded the knife into the Belfast lock, searches of that area turned up absolutely nothing. Still, the jury had Gordon's confession, a disturbing, vivid account of a spontaneous killing. And one other piece of circumstantial testimony threatened to sway opinion. Mrs. Hetty Little, the woman who had originally seen a pale, nervous man in a long coat leaving Glenhouse. This was at around 6:30 p.m., she said, on the night of the murder. When she was called to identify Gordon in the police lineup, she picked him out. But under cross-examination, it was revealed that she had already seen his photograph printed in the newspaper prior to identification. And that cast serious doubt on the objectivity of her memory. The trial dragged on, tense and dramatic. Every development was reported in the press. The public was divided. Some were convinced Gordon was guilty. Others whispered about a possible cover-up, that Gordon had been picked as a scapegoat to protect someone closer to the Kern family. On the 7th of March, 1953, the jury retired to consider their verdict. The courtroom fell into an uneasy silence. Reporters noted the tension. People held their breath. It had been a long and deeply unsettling trial. Just 2 hours later, the jury returned with their decision. Guilty, but insane. It was a carefully worded verdict that offered a middle ground. In legal terms, it meant the jury believed Gordon had committed the act, but that his mental state at the time meant he could not have been held fully responsible for it. He would not face prison, but he would be committed indefinitely to a psychiatric institution. The courtroom's reaction was intense. Gordon was sitting there pale and withdrawn in the dock, and he showed little emotion. His parents, who had been flown in from Scotland, were visibly upset and shaken. His mother was in tears. Outside, a crowd of over 1,000 people broke into cheers and applause as the verdict was announced. For many, justice had been served. But for others, the doubts remained. Gordon was sent to Holywell Psychiatric Hospital in County Antrim, where he would remain under medical supervision indefinitely. He was just 21 years of age, and at the time, that seemed to be the end of the story. But in truth, nothing about the current case ever truly ended. Too many questions remained unanswered. Too many details didn't quite fit. And Ian Hay Gordon, the man convicted but declared insane, would live with the consequences of that verdict for decades to come. Even with the verdict delivered and Ian Hay Gordon locked away in Holywell, The case, as I said, never truly settled in the public mind. If anything, the trial had opened more questions than it had answers. There was always unease about the role of the Kern family in the investigation. Why had they moved Patricia's body before the police arrived? Why had the house not been properly secured as a crime scene? Some reports even suggested there was a large bloodstain in the house itself, a detail that, if true, could mean Patricia had been attacked and moved outdoors after she was stabbed. That alone was enough to feed years of speculation. People wondered, was someone being protected? Was Gordon simply a convenient outsider, a socially awkward, solitary young man with no powerful connections, chosen to carry the blame? The Kerns never publicly addressed the trial or the suspicion that followed them. Sir Lancelot remained on the bench. The family did leave Glenhouse soon after the trial and never returned. Meanwhile, Gordon began his indefinite commitment at Holywell Psychiatric Hospital. The institution, like others of its kind in the 1950s, was stark and clinical, and whatever its intent, Holywell was not a place of healing. Gordon was kept under psychiatric supervision, medicated, and essentially cut off from the outside world. Visitors were few. His name faded from the headlines. He was, for all intents and purposes, erased from the public's eye. A legal loose end tied off neatly with a label, guilty but insane. He would remain in Holywell for 7 years. In that time, no new evidence emerged. No further investigation into the Kern family was launched. The case officially was closed. But for those who paid attention, the journalists, the legal observers, and especially those who knew Patricia, the unease never really went away. Because the central question still hung in the air. Did the right man go to Holywell? And if not, who did kill Patricia Kern? After spending 7 years confined at Holywell Psychiatric Hospital, Ian Hay Gordon was quietly released in August of 1960. His release, of course, came with strict conditions. He was to change his name and refrain from discussing the case publicly. Returning to Glasgow, he adopted a new identity and secured employment with a publishing company. For over 3 decades, Gordon lived as a non-person, his true identity and the circumstances of his past concealed from those around him. Despite the passage of time, Gordon never relinquished his quest to clear his name. In 1969, he took the bold step of writing directly to the then Prime Minister, Harold Wilson, appealing for a re-examination of his case in the interest of basic human justice. In his letter, Gordon detailed the circumstances of his conviction and the support he had garnered from various legal and medical professionals who believed he was innocent. Gordon's appeal highlighted the involvement of prominent figures who had expressed doubts about his guilt, including the Attorney General, the Lord Chancellor, and the distinguished psychiatrist, Dr. Kern, no relation to the other Kerns. Despite their support, his plea did not lead to any immediate action. The case remained dormant until the late 1990s, when the Criminal Case Review Commission began investigating potential miscarriages of justice. In 1998, the CCRC referred Gordon's case to the Northern Ireland Court of Appeal. The appeal centred on the reliability of Gordon's confession, which had been obtained after prolonged police interrogation without legal representation. During the appeal, it was revealed that Detective Superintendent John Capstick, who had led the original investigation, had misrepresented the circumstances under which Gordon's confession was obtained. Capstick had claimed that Gordon voluntarily dictated his statement, but evidence presented during the appeal indicated that the confession was the result of intense and coercive questioning. On the 20th of December 2000, the Court of Appeal quashed Gordon's conviction, declaring it unsafe. Lord Chief Justice Sir Robert Carswell delivered the judgment, acknowledging that the confession was inadmissible and that the conviction could not stand. Gordon, who was then 68, expressed relief at finally having his name cleared, stating, "I feel a great burden has been lifted off my shoulders. I'm overjoyed to have my name finally cleared and become an ordinary individual once again. The overturning of Gordon's conviction brought renewed scrutiny to the original investigation and the conduct of the Kern family. Questions persisted about the family's actions on the night of Patricia's murder, including the decision to move her body and the lack of physical evidence linking Gordon to the crime. Despite the quashing of his conviction, no further investigation was launched to identify the true perpetrator. Gordon lived out his remaining years in relative obscurity, passing away in 2012. In 2009, the BBC had aired a drama titled Scapegoat, which revisited Patricia Curran's case. The programme ventured into speculative territory, suggesting that Patricia's mother, Doris Curran, may have been involved in her daughter's death. It's crucial to note that this portrayal is a dramatised interpretation and not based on concrete evidence. The Curran family has always denied any involvement in Patricia's murder. No direct evidence has ever linked any family member to the crime, and the allegations presented in the drama remain unsubstantiated. As I said, after the trial in 1953, the Curran family left Glen House for good. The property where Patricia had been found murdered was sold, and the family withdrew almost completely from public life. While Ian Hay Gordon had been sent to a psychiatric hospital, many in the public still had questions, not just about the murder, but about how the case was handled and what the role, if any, the family may have played in how it unfolded. Sir Lancelot Curran, Patricia's father, continued to serve as a High Court judge in Northern Ireland. He didn't step down immediately and made no public comment about the investigation, the trial, or the doubts surrounding the case. He retired in 1967 and died in 1984. While he remained professionally respected, some journalists and legal figures continued to question whether his influence had shaped the direction of the investigation, particularly in the early days when critical evidence had been missed or mishandled. Lady Doris Curran, Patricia's mother, faded from public life almost entirely. She had a complicated personal history, and there were long-standing reports that she struggled with her mental health, even before Patricia's death. After the murder, those issues reportedly worsened. There were rumours, never confirmed, that she was institutionalised for a time. She died quietly, and the exact details of her later years have not been well documented. Desmond Curran, Patricia's older brother, was the one who found her body. He was studying law at the time, but the trauma of that night changed the direction of his life completely. He left his legal career behind and became a Catholic priest, a surprising move for a son of a Protestant judge. Desmond eventually moved to South Africa, where he worked in the missionary service for many years. He stayed out of the public eye and never gave interviews about the case. He died in the early 2000s. Michael Curran, the middle sibling, maintained an even lower profile than Desmond. Very little is publicly known about his life after 1953. He's believed to have moved away from Northern Ireland and, like the rest of the family, never made any public statements about Patricia's death or the trial of Ian Hay Gordon. So no member of the Curran family ever offered further explanation or comment about what happened. They left behind a closed front door and a long list of questions. Over the years, writers, journalists and legal experts have continued to debate whether the full truth of what happened to Patricia was ever uncovered or whether those answers were buried with the family. You know, the more I sat with this story, the more it started to feel like something was just off. There's the official version, the confession, the trial, the verdict, and then everything sitting just beneath it. The silence, the things that never quite lined up. It's hard to ignore the way the Curran family handled it all, moving the body before police arrived, withdrawing completely afterwards, no real statements, no public grief. Maybe that was their way of coping, or maybe it was something else. Either way, it left space for suspicion to grow, and it did, it still does. I'm not saying they were hiding something, but I am saying this. When powerful people close ranks, and the truth becomes blurred by influence, reputation, and fear, justice can slip through the cracks. As for Patricia, whatever happened that night, she didn't deserve it. And I can't help but think the full truth of her story died with the people who never told it. Maybe we'll never know who really killed her, but I don't think the right questions were ever asked. So guys, that's it for today's episode of the Ireland Crimes and Mysteries podcast. Again, thanks for your listenership, and don't forget to subscribe to the show and hit that auto download so you never miss an episode. Until the next time, keep your eyes open and your mind curious. This podcast has been compiled from information gathered in the public sphere, like news articles, documentaries, and open source material that can be found on the web. Everything in this podcast is alleged unless a conviction has taken place.